We don't have to do testing.
No, I think we'll be okay. I'll trust the technology. So, Alice, can you tell me how and at what point in your life you became involved in social enterprise?
I moved to Scotland in early 1980s. And after about 2 years, when I was sort of getting towards the end of building my house, I was friends with John Pearce. And I'd been in touch with community enterprises and community businesses in the west of Scotland, and we went to visit Government Workspace, and John and I put together the idea that we could not replicate but use some of the example of Government Workspace to convert an old set of co-op buildings in West Calder into a managed workspace, which would be in many ways a hedge against the massive unemployment that was happening in the area at the time. West Lothian then had come to a point when the mines were all closing, and by 1985 they had all closed, and British Leyland factory was shutting down, Plessy was shutting down. In some communities around here there was up to 25% unemployment, and a lot of and all the kind of social issues and problems related to that, as you might imagine. West Calder was an old mining village. It is an old mining village, and stood a little bit aside from the worst of it, but nonetheless there was quite a lot of unemployment locally, and some of these buildings, which were town centre at the time, were looking in disrepair. The co-op had been an important, a vital part of West Calder's history. And they ran a department store, a transport department, a butchery, and they had an industrial bakery as well, which serviced a wide area of West Lothian. All these buildings were closed down by about 1983. And John and I looked at the buildings. We managed to get the keys and so on. And looked through the buildings, and we put together the idea of a scheme for turning both the industrial bakery, which is, from memory, something like 13,500 square feet, and what had been the old co-op Main Street department store, into a linked community project that would create about three or four different aspects. In the old bakery, we wanted to be more industrial, commercial. The old department store, we thought the future might lie in retail, perhaps small-scale retail, and market, with a market, with some flats and residential above. So we contacted various housing associations. I think Edinvar was the one that we picked to work with us on that project, and put together a scheme which we took and presented at a public meeting in, I think, March 1983, at the Community Council in West Calder. But we deliberately invited the four or five other Community Council representatives from around the area, which had all previously had some allegiance, is not the right word, but some sense of West Calder being their centre, because West Calder was the retail centre. And it was a very well-attended public meeting when we presented the idea and got a kind of nod and approval from the Community Council that they would support, or the Community Councils, rather, that they would support the notion of setting up a project which would be employment generating, and which would honour some of the heritage of the village by using some of the buildings. I think the key factor that brought people out was the fact that the big shop window had been broken by kids, and people saw that as a symbol of decline. So that's how I got involved. My background was in building and architecture, so I had the ability to be able to sort of sketch out the ideas onto paper and draw them up in such a way that we could present them as an option, as a possibility.
You mentioned that you'd visited Govern Workspace in preparation for the work in West Calder. At that time, what, you know, did you find inspirational, or what did you think that Govan was doing that you thought would work in West Calder?
Well, two things really. From a kind of architecture and building standpoint, they'd used an old redundant primary school, St Anthony's, I think it was called, in the lovely named Harmony Row. And the other was the fact that they spoke passionately about the role that a project like that could have in an area suffering even worse than we were suffering in West Lothian, in the old shipyard area of Glasgow. So it was something about their enthusiasm and their passion that struck me as kind of the critical heart of the project, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And was there any differences in what you had to consider in kind of transplanting this idea into West?
Yes, quite a few, really. One is this kind of social context, and this is we call it a village. It's a town of about 3,000 people, and the greater area is probably 5,000 or 6,000 people, so completely different to West of Scotland inner city project. So the context was different. The building we hoped we'd be able to own the building, and I'll come back to that later on, because there's a story around ownership of the property that is quite critical. We had no money. We had only enthusiasm and the ability to organise. Well, John's ability to organise. I remember at the public meeting, I was so nervous talking to the assembled company that the sweat was dripping from my forehead onto the acetates that I prepared and dissolving the drawings that I'd done. So this was being projected onto the wall as a sort of disappearing project. I don't know where they are now. I think they're with the council archive, the ones I took. Yeah, it was that enthusiasm and that sense of purpose, really. Yeah.
So you mentioned that the community council were initially very supportive. Did you feel that the community as a whole was supportive? Did they get the idea, or where did you draw support from there?
That was quite problematic at first, because it was people regretted the closure of these buildings, but some of the traders used to mutter about us because a market had been part of the proposal. I remember walking along the street and the ironmonger walking behind me saying, "Bandits, bandits, bandits," because he thought I was going to be stealing his trade, whereas what we were really trying to do was to bring some trade and life and business back into the village, and to run it for community benefit. But we made quite a lot of presentations apart from that initial presentation in order to build up knowledge and skills. And we ran events. Eventually we ran events that brought people to it, supported the brass band, supported the local football team. But that's all after the project was established. Mm. At that early time, I think it was a mystery. One other key element was that the community education worker, a woman at that time called Sheila Gardner, I think she changed her name later, was enormously supportive and very helpful. We were able to use the community centre facilities, spaces, photocopying, all those things that you don't have access to unless somebody's going to help you do it. So that was really of critical importance. Two other main actors in this were the local authorities, both the region and the district, and we'll come back to them, and also it was called BASE, Bathgate Area Support for Enterprise. It was a local employment, they had a special name, I've forgotten it now, that was set up at Enterprise Centre, so they were seen as the gateway through which you would access support and advice, I suppose, really. Yeah. But they all came in really later. It was really around John's ability to help organise this as an idea and present it. And of course we did a sort of broad brush business plan. Let me see what happened next. Well, it took us about a year to move from the presentation of the initial idea to persuading the local authority to buy the buildings. But in fact, we only were able to buy one of the buildings, not two. So we bought the old Co-op bakery. I say we bought, the council bought, for £20,000, the council bought this old Co-op bakery. And we, concomitant with that was the idea that we needed public support of some kind or other. And so the council had some support through Urban Aid. They were able to borrow the money outside their borrowing limits, which allowed them to borrow that money to create the money that would be used to convert the building from an old bakery into 40 small workshops. So the local authority, the district, West Lothian District Council, was a partner from the beginning, but they used perhaps different criteria to the ones we used for judging both the potential and eventual success or not of the project.
And I'm assuming that became perhaps a bit of a stumbling block somewhere.
Hugely problematic.
Down the line. So could you tell me a bit more about how things developed maybe before we get on to those, those later things? How did you start to fill these 40 spaces?
Well, once we knew that the council was going to raise some money to convert the building and lease it to us, and that we had some Urban Aid revenue support for 7 years, we felt confident that we would move forward. So on an organisational level, we set up a company, just a single company, West Quarter Workspace Limited, which was a company limited by guarantee. I can't remember if at the outset it had charitable status. I don't think it did. It may have done. We had help from Stephen Phillips from Glasgow, who had experience of memorandum and articles of association from the community business movement. And Stephen came and helped us set the company up. So once we had the company, we had to recruit board members. So our board members were recruited from the membership, so we did a membership drive. But they also had representation from the five community councils that centred on West Calder. So as of right, each of those community councils could represent, could nominate somebody to be on the board. So we felt that that gave us a firmer footing in kind of local governance issues. I think there was one community council that practically never sent anybody, but the other three or four did and were permanent and staunch members of the board. I think we had a board of about 12 or 13 people, and armed with that board and the idea that the building was going to be converted, we ran a little marketing campaign and let the first four units quite early on. They were, I've got a picture of them somewhere here, they were just like sheds really in what was called the old dispatch block. I'll look for the picture later. And the first few tenants included a woman who made wedding dresses, somebody who provided a saw sharpening service, a local person who ran a gas fitting company, and a third one, I can't remember. And then that marketing campaign was extended once the rest of the building, piece by piece, came on stream. And that took over about 6 months, I suppose. We worked towards fulfilling the space. We had, I think in the end, it was about 35 workshops built in the first phase. Some of them were in the big bakery building. Some of them were in the kind of stable block yard around, at the end of which was a house, and that house was our centre, our management centre. So we recruited staff to run the workspace. A manager, who was all we had at first. So I think a manager and a secretary was all we started with. Yeah.
And for the marketing campaign, was that done through local newspapers, radio? Did you have to go out and do different events? Get
can't remember.
A bit of a sweat.
Certainly, we ran something in the local newspapers. Certainly, we spoke at lots of venues and through BASE, through Bathgate Area Support for Enterprise. People, if they were a big, they sort of considered the workspace as part of their portfolio of property that was available for rent. It was at a time when self-employment was just kind of ticking over locally in West Lothian, just beginning to be thought about. So people were recommended towards this space. After about a year or so, we decided that what we needed was, as well as the kind of physical spaces that people could rent, what we needed was something more which would engender tenants. So we set up a subsidiary charity called, at that time, the Employment Opportunities Trust, which was specifically about trying to move long-term unemployed people through the process of thinking through an idea into maybe trying out an idea. We considered the workspace was a good place to try out an idea because we had leases that only ran for were a month either way, so you weren't tied in with a long lease. So you could it was a good place to fail, if you like, as well as a good place to succeed. And so the Employment Opportunities Trust had two arms to it, one of which was a community workshop where we taught classes in all sorts of range of skills and crafts, and joinery, knitting, fly tying, dressmaking. We got machinery and equipment from here, there and everywhere to run the classes. And it was also a kind of enterprise support element to it. So leading people through the idea of becoming self-employed. And we were successful in getting money from something called the Voluntary Projects Programme, which was a subset of the Manpower Services Commission, which at that time ran the community programme and then was beginning to think beyond the community programme to other aspects of self-employment. And so we had enough money to employ three or four people. In fact, I became employed by them as well, part-time. Previously, I'd been a volunteer. To run the Employment Opportunities Trust, to run classes, and to provide the advice and support. And I remember that the target, we had £30,000 a year, which in 1985 sounded like quite a lot of money. And our target, the target that we were set by Manpower Services Commission, was that we should get six people into full-time employment, either self-employed or whatever, in a year, because at that time they recognised, or they reckoned, that it cost £5,000 a year to keep somebody on the dole. Therefore, if we got six people off the dole and into employment, we were paying for ourselves. The lesson, of course, is that targets diminish and diminish and diminish. So that over the years, by about the fourth year of that funding, we still had £30,000, but we had to get 30 people into employment rather than six. So meeting those targets became more and more onerous and difficult. Mm-hmm. Difficult. So that gave us two branches. It gave us the idea of engendering enterprising attitudes. So, but alongside that, we recognised that only a small proportion of people could really face the challenges, or wanted to face the challenges, of becoming self-employed, running their own business. So we began to think that we should be setting up something which is more about direct employment ourselves. We had the workspace, which was property management. We had the Employment Opportunities Trust, which was providing advice and support. And what we needed was something that would employ people. So in about a year and a half later, we set up something called West Calder Community Enterprises, which was a building and joinery company, and which was specifically aimed to employ long-term unemployed people and to create jobs for long-term unemployed people in building and joinery, previously long-term unemployed people. We used that company initially. There was something called the community program, which you've probably heard about, which was enormously helpful because it allowed you to employ people for, I think it was 20 hours a week, and the government, through the subsidy, would pay their wages. And so gradually we were able to move people. It was for 6 months or 12 months, I can't remember now. We were able to move people from that 20 hours a week to 35-hour week, paying the rest out of the income that we generated. So it was a tremendous project, community program, and what was it overtaken by employment, ET, employment training. Yeah, it was overtaken by employment training. This whole push that government had to have, which was about being innovative and changing the structure and also paying less for what it was getting, undermined that usefulness of the community program. So after about 4 years, I think, the community program disappeared, and we were no longer able to use that as a really powerful route to get people through into eased into employment, and then onto fuller employment, self-generated income through the community enterprise project. So that gives us three legs: the property management company, the employment advice and training, and the building and joinery direct employment company. So we began to look at how these were tied together, and it seemed a good idea to have a kind of overarching structure, legal structure. We set up West Calder Community Holdings, which is, as it says, a holding company for all the other endeavours that the project wanted to engage in.
And who was that governed by? Was that the same board?
Well, it was representatives of there were three boards, one for each of these companies, and it was representatives from each of those companies that were onto the West Calder Community Holdings. I think that the council was there as well, I can't remember what the relationship of the community councils is to that, but I seem to remember that BASE and the district council were represented on the West Calder Community Holdings Board as well. Mm-hmm. So we had a structure in place that we hoped would be a kind of firm footing for future expansion and endeavours.
Okay, so what year are we up to now? How many years did it take you to get all those things in place?
We had the initial presentation of the idea in 1983. We had the building or construction, the conversion phase in maybe 1984, when the workspace company was set up. 1985, the Employment Opportunities Trust was set up. 1987, maybe something like that, the West Calder Community Enterprises was set up, and then maybe the same year, West Calder Community Holdings. So about 3 or 4 years, a piece at a time, putting the pieces in place.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I'm quite interested in what you're saying about the community program. And the different layers of that the workspace drew in, people who were already able to set up a business themselves, and then people that perhaps needed some support, and then also trying to draw in people who were long-term unemployed from the area. What kind of, was it ex-miners that were the people who were coming
indeed
into that stream?
The There was a really good report by Scottish Education Action for Development, which was done in the early 80s, called Bathgate on the Edge, which, if you haven't got a copy, you need to get a copy of. They were a good left-wing think tank based in Scotland, based in Edinburgh. And Bathgate on the Edge showed how, at that time even, international capital and the movement of capital had affected West Lothian. 1850, it's a rural area. 1860, 1870, get the start of the world's oil industry in West Lothian. Grows to be a huge endeavour locally. 1961, it's all over. All the shale mining has closed down. Coal mining is becoming more difficult. All the small mines are closed down. Polkemmet still existed. And in terms of Bathgate on the Edge, two or three things. Leyland was closing down. Leyland had been set up by the Wilson government, I think. There were four projects set up in Scotland. British Leyland in Bathgate. Linwood factory making the Hillman Imp in Ferguson Park, or next to Ferguson Park. Invergordon, the smelter in near Dingwall, and Corpa, the paper mill near Fort William. All four of those projects had died. They were set up as brave ventures, really, about bringing working time back. So that cycle of investment and then removal is a familiar story for West Lothian. It's happening again now. Motorola, which was here, was gone, you know, and that's all happened in the last 30 years, kind of thing. I think West Lothian's turned the corner now, at last, but that's a wider discussion. So the people that we were working with may well have been miners, but already made redundant from the mines, and quite a number of them, four or five, had worked at British Leyland. And they're made redundant there, you know, years on from being closed down as miners. So their skill sets were very different, and their way of organising themselves was very different. They were about working for a big company, and it's a very different, particularly then, it was a very different kind of mental set that they were engaged with, as it were. So, yeah, they were, they had all sorts of checkered histories. But I remember four or five people who had been miners and then had gone, Andy, Davey, Alex. They'd all, mainly blokes, they'd all gone to, they'd all been miners and gone to Leyland. So we tried to create new opportunities around the skill sets that they had and new skills that they might be able to employ as well. When the Voluntary Projects Programme disappeared from the Employment Opportunities Trust and ET came in, aptly named, the Employment Opportunities Trust changed its name to Trust Training and expanded greatly and used government contracts to run employment advice projects. Previously, we've been quite small, with three or four members of staff paid through the Voluntary Projects Programme. We ran enterprise allowance classes. Enterprise allowance was a brilliant thing, gave you 20 quid a week for a half a year and helped you and allowed you to earn money while you were still on the dole. It was very useful. Other tricks and tools were through the Voluntary Projects Programme. People were allowed to earn money to try out their business, but without the loss of benefit. Can you imagine that now? we had to hold that money for them, but it was there. They were allowed to earn it and then utilise it once they'd formally set up their business. An amazing support. Coupled with enterprise allowance, that now allowed people to experiment in all different kinds of ways. We ran classes for the Prince's Trust on youth employment ventures. So we became a little a local hub for those sorts of endeavours. The trust training became very large, and eventually moved away from the workspace premises to Bathgate, where it ran itself almost as a separate entity. And I'll tell you what happened to the workspace alongside that in a moment.
So what kind of futures were these guys that you were working with, who'd been made redundant, you know, twice from different industries, what kind of futures were they envisaging for themselves? Where were you trying to get them to when they walked through the door?
I think the phrase that was most often used was dodging away. A bit of this and a bit of that. People have different ambitions. There's no general set there. But I think what they wanted to do was to earn a living, and not having to hunt and dodge and dive as they'd been kind of led into by the disappointment of work disappearing on so many occasions for them. So some people really wanted to change their skill set. Some people wanted to just get by. So we had quite a few Janis and handymen. Some people were looking to create opportunities for themselves and their families. A whole variety of things. But really, I think it's that basic thing of pride in bringing home a bit of money. It's so simple, so straightforward. They wanted to make a living. Yeah. That's the main thing I remember, including me.
So, in 1987, were you fairly optimistic about the future of the workplace?
Hugely optimistic. I can't remember the dates exactly, probably about 88 or 89. With the building and joinery company that we had, we converted the top floor of the bakery, which is a big space, 3,500 square feet. We converted that into small workshops, and we used our own building and joinery company. So we created employment by directly investing in the property. That was a big project for us. We used mainly our own labour for doing that. And these were guys who'd either been part of British Leyland, or some of them were younger, unemployed people, but they were all recruited through West Calder Community Enterprises. And the start point for many of them was community programme. Not all, but many. And then a year after that, we converted another part of the building. We created two upper floors in a very high space. And which had several managers by then, and the manager at the time helped us shape up a submission to the Times RIBA Community Enterprise Awards, and we won an award. And I remember the manager, myself, two or three board members all went down to London and picked up the Times RIBA award, which felt really like we were going somewhere, like it was important. We had the brass band used to practice in the big room upstairs. We had exhibitions up there. It thrived. It was busy. And that's kind of at the end of the 80s, end of the beginning of the 90s. So I felt very optimistic. It felt really like it was going somewhere.
And did you feel like you'd overcome that initial stage of scepticism that you faced from the community initially?
Oh, very much so. We recruited members. I think at our most we had about 150 local people signed up as members. One of the issues probably is that we never considered enough of that people might like a return in some kind or other. Not, I don't mean money, I don't mean a dividend, but some kind of return on their investment. As a member, and maybe we should have considered I don't know, some other kinds of benefits, like an annual outing or whatever, you know. But yeah, we had about 150 members, I seem to remember. You'll have read West Called Wind. That's our story.
Yeah.
In the Learning from Failure series, yeah. So here we are, early 1990s. I must have been there about 7 years of involvement by then, 7 or 8 years of involvement, and wondering what I should, whether I should be staying or should I go or whatever. But and of course there were problems and issues that came, that come up, and you know, you get this thing where the same problem comes up maybe 3 years later, and you think, I've done this, I've fought this through, you know. And there was a sort of perfect storm that came in about early 1990s, I can't remember exactly when. Three things happened to us. There was yet another recession, so people just weren't, were fearing the consequences of setting up in business. The Urban Aid came to an end. It hadn't been much, but we had £30,000 a year, which was, I think it was 30, which was enough to support some of the kind of admin staff and part of the management team. And the council decided to increase the rent, which had been never a peppercorn, but shall we say a pot of chilli, and increased the rent to a commercial rent. And one of the things that really, really annoyed us was that all the improvements that we'd made, we'd funded, we'd raised the money for, we'd borrowed money and invested in the building, were then reflected in an increased rent, a commercial rent for the building. So with those three things coming together, it became more and more difficult to sustain the project, which ran on very tight margins from the beginning. Because we never we had tried to own, we tried to buy the building, and the council would have sold us the building, but at a proper commercial price. Their estates department insisted that they did it as a proper commercial venture, which it completely ignored the fact that unless we had been involved and got the Urban Aid, which came to us and allowed the council to borrow, they wouldn't have had an asset in the first place. So it was enormously aggravating. A couple of years before that, we had looked at one of the big houses in the area called Limefield House, an old Georgian house, which was considered to be owned by the community. It had been owned by Paraffin Young, and then his niece, Miss Tom, had lived there, and in the 50s, I think, had left it to the community as, the phrase was, eventide home, an eventide home. So it was a retirement home run by the local authority. In this case, the Lothian Regional Council. And we, they were closing it down and moving to other places. And we looked, we put together an idea of turning it into a dementia care centre. This would be about 1991, 92. We invested a lot of time and energy. We raised a bit of money here and there. We invested a lot of time and energy, and John did the business plan for it, in seeing how we might do that, how we might fund it. We had big partners involved, a big housing association, Edinburgh again, I think, or Kenmore, Alzheimer's Scotland, the King's Fund, and it looked on paper, the way these things often do, it looked like a go, it looked a possibility, but what we needed was the council, who then considered it was theirs rather than the community's, to sell it to us, make it over to us in some way or other, and they wouldn't do it. Again, so we ran up against that with the council once, had already run up against that with the council. So we were pretty well loggerheads with the council. Council owned the building we were working from, the old Colt Bakery, West Quarter Workspace. They owned Limefield House, and we couldn't move into that new position of control over the assets in order to be able to borrow some money to do some to invest to reinvest in the for community benefit. And I think the spirit began to go out a little bit of the project. And then when the income from rents dropped away, that left us with even tighter margins. We began to lay people off, as we felt we needed to do, both in the building and joinery company and in the workspace company. The part that survived most strongly was the employment advice, because it was running on government contracts. And eventually, we had to call it a day. We didn't have enough money to run it. We had bought one property from the co-op. It was the old cobbler's workshop, which was next to the workspace. So this was our sole piece of ownership. We bought that from Scottish Midland Co-op, but we had to sell that. Or in fact, it was taken as part of the debt that we owed the council for the rent we hadn't paid. We had to sell that. We had to give up the workspace, give up the joinery company. And the Employment Opportunities Trust, as I said, had become much more self-reliant and self-standing and less linked to the whole initial project. And located elsewhere. That went on for another 2 or 3 years, that project, and then it ran foul of various things, changes in government contract, a slight misrepresentation of the figures. You had to prove that people were still in employment 6 months after they stopped with you because you were paid retrospectively for the work that you'd done. And then that too folded. So the whole project lasted 12 years, maybe, something like 12 years.
I'm interested in the kind of changing relationship with the council, who'd been initially supportive.
Reluctant but supportive.
Reluctant. And then kind of became a major stumbling block in kind of taking the project to kind of a next level. Do you think that was because the council changed their mind about the community business and what you were trying to do? Or do you think they'd had different values and ambitions from the outset and eventually they clashed? You know, was there a change or was it just an eventual clash?
Well, it's hard for me to give anything other than a subjective response to that. I'd say that the council didn't speak as one voice from the beginning. There were always doubters, detractors, people trying to put spoke in our wheels, as well as supporters there. The council liked to be hands-off in a curious kind of way. And I think that as soon as the financial issues became more difficult for us, that gave the council the opportunity for those voices to gain a bit of ground. After all, they felt they owned the property, and they weren't flexible enough. They weren't receptive to the ethos of the place. Eventually, they weren't. Perhaps they had been earlier, although they were always, in my view, slightly difficult.
And what did they not get about the project, or what were they constrained by, do you think?
Well, money was the first thing, right? They weren't getting much money for it. They were getting the rent. I can't remember what we paid initially. They saw also, since they owned the property, they had an ongoing responsibility towards the building in some way or other. What they didn't get was the whole idea that you needed this multi... One approach was to have this multifaceted endeavour, which has a bit of straight property management But then within that is the idea of, yeah, but it's only a month either way, you know, so it's still, it's a good place to rent somewhere. People stayed for a long time or they stayed for a short time. It was just dependent on their business. Excuse me. Yeah, I mean, the simple way to describe it is they didn't get it. They didn't get the idea. They saw it, the Estates Department saw it as a bit of property. The economic development, there was always planning that were the economic development bits in the council at that time. So the planners, the economic development people, saw it as... maybe worth trying, but, you know, maybe it wasn't really a full endeavour. I'm sure their view of it would be quite different, but our sense of it was that we were always slightly at loggerheads with the council. There was never or very little enthusiasm for what we were doing. And you need enthusiasm. Because without it, it helps you. It values. It's like when we've won a number of awards, and whenever you win an award, that's like saying somebody recognises what you're doing is a value, and that's enormously helpful. And we never had a sense that we were getting that from the council. We were always sort of battling with the council.
You mentioned also with the transition from the community programme to
employment training.
There was different targets set for the numbers of people that were...
Well, that was even within the community programme, yeah.
Okay, gaining full-time employment. So were they only valuing your work on a numerical basis? And did that contrast how you were?
Well, when you say they, that presupposes that there were community program people around that you could talk with, and that was very rarely the opportunity. We did go down to Sheffield, where the Manpower Services Commission were based, in I think probably 1986, at the end of our first year of running the voluntary projects program within the community program, and. We got, actually that's right, because the VPP, Voluntary Projects Programme, was about volunteering. The Community Programme always had this element of paid employment, but the Voluntary Projects Programme was about volunteering. And it was a special enterprise development subset within the VPP that was looking towards pushing self-employment and enterprise development. So we did meet people at that point, and then people came up. We were forever showing people from all over the world and all over different departments. There was something called the SDA, the Scottish Development Agency, which predates the enterprise companies. They were always coming to us. We had good support. We had very good support from somebody in the Urban Aid Department. I wish I could remember her name. I'm pretty sure it was Isabel or something. She was really very supportive. For example, used to bring people along and even bought some furniture that we'd made and so on. So there were supporters, but a bit further flung. The people who were in contact with, there was always this... of it's a struggle. And it was a struggle, you know.
And do you think the problems you encountered with your local authorities and the timing that, you know, of the kind of early 1990s, was this kind of something unique to West Calder? Or were the problems you were facing part of a wider kind of discrediting or questioning of the community business movement across Scotland?
I need to go back three steps.
Okay.
Soon after we established the workspace, sort of early 80s, really, I and others became involved in something called Community Business Lothian, which was a voluntary group that came together and met in Edinburgh once a month. It included somebody called Graham Robertson, who was the community development person from Livingston Development Corporation nearby. John Hoy from Craig's Farm, which is a project you need to know about. Various other people who were involved, and people from Craig Miller and so on. So we used to come together to talk about how we were going to promote community enterprise, community business in the Lothians. And it was a small voluntary group called Community Business Lothian. And so here we are. So it's part of the zeitgeist of the time, of that time, that people were receptive to the idea of communities getting together to tackle some of the issues raised by large-scale unemployment and disadvantage. We eventually managed, with the rolling out of the idea of community business and community enterprise across Scotland, by about 1986 or 87, we were able to move from being a voluntary organisation, Community Business Lothian, and it became Community Enterprise Lothian Limited, CEL, an interesting word, which was set up with staff and members and grants from the councils. I say councils because it was region, the region and the four districts, each provided a bit of money towards that, and was set up in Edinburgh as an organisation to help promote and support the growth of community enterprise and community endeavour. So it was in the air at that time. I think by about, although it was never fully espoused by people, I think by about the 90s, the beginning of the 90s, the voices against were becoming dominant. People moved on within the local authorities, so there were new people coming in, had their own mark to make. So the support gradually began to sort of fritter away. And CEL, however, carried on into the future. But I think there was a whole shift of emphasis early 90s, which looked away from the community options towards a variety of things. One was municipal enterprise, seen as kind of arm's length things from the council. One was we must attract more big business to create employment, all of which are part of the picture. But somehow it seemed to be at the expense of the small scale starts. And in that work that I was involved in then, and in later work that I've been involved in, unless you are planting those seeds at local level, then you don't have the you can't grow it from nothing. So the social enterprise movement now is resurgent, but it's quite different from the community business, community enterprise movement of the 80s and into the 90s. It's qualitatively quite different. Its emphasis is different. It's not so much, in my view, about collective endeavour, and much more about endeavour which has a social purpose. I'll leave it at that. Things move on.
Indeed.
So Community Enterprise Lothian still exists, but not called, it's called, now called Community Enterprise Limited. It's based in Oatridge in West Lothian, and it's a direct descendant of that Community Business Lothian, Community Enterprise Lothian, and there's a direct line that runs to Community Enterprise Limited, which is now a commercial development agency. I mean, with a lot of the right values, but, you know, it's self-supporting, earns its living. Mm. So it has to do a lot of work.
Mm. I'd like to maybe talk a little bit about how you understand or evaluate the value of a project like what it's called a workplace. Because for me, that's quite a complex thing. And especially when you're involved with numerous agencies that are asking you to prove that you've, you know, got X amount of people into employment for X amount of time in order to release funds.
Yeah.
What was that like at the time? Was there a pressure to do that at the time?
Well, you always had to, we were a company, you always had to do your annual accounts. So there's a hard line there. So we had to present three sets of annual accounts because we had three companies. We may well have amalgamated them and shown cross support and so on here and there. But nevertheless, so that's the money. We always felt we had a value beyond the money, or value that could be counted in a different way. And so we used to do an annual report, which I wonder if I think I've probably sent them to you in the past. Or if not, they'll be with all that material that's parked at West Lothian Archive. And they were quite simple things, but they did report on aspirations. They reported on just the shape, the straight numbers of people employed, community projects supported, other kinds of community benefit that came out of it, ambitions for the future. There's our three companies. The number of seagulls is significant. One seagull was the workspace, two seagulls was the Employment Opportunities Trust, and three seagulls was the Community Enterprise Company. So those reports went to our members. That was our first line of responsibility. And then beyond the members, they went to the councils and the local authorities and the funders and so on. I should have mentioned Calouste Gulbenkian Foundation, who were huge support for some of the work that we did. Around this time, measuring social wealth was beginning to be thought about. I say around this time, towards the end of my period of time with West Cordon Workspace. Because I should say I left in 1993, after 10 years, I thought I needed to move in a different kind of way. So we did the annual reports, we made presentations, but we didn't have a methodology. We didn't have a clear methodology for reporting on what we were doing. We had to do reports as part of, you know, if ever we got any funding, we had to report on how it was spent. If ever we were supported by government programs, we had to report against their parameters, which were usually, you know, about money and numbers. But perhaps we didn't realise that we needed, but we could have done with social audit and accounting as a way of demonstrating our worth in fields other than the money, which we had to do for Companies House, but also in ways in which showed our environmental worth, our the recycling that we did, or it was all done. So it was all done, but not perhaps celebrated enough, and certainly not reported on in any way that anybody would recognise these days as an efficient report. So yeah, it's a missing piece of the jigsaw, probably. Essentially, I think we reported to satisfy the needs of others, rather than to satisfy our own needs. I never put it that way before, but that's what it seemed to me, in retrospect, to be like. Yeah. So monitoring and evaluation was really only just being pushed as part of the whole world in which we lived at that time. It wasn't part of the general thread that ran through things in the way that it is now. Mm. Yeah.
And if you were to go back to that time, I mean, a lot of the imperative for these West Calder Workspace and other community businesses was to address unemployment. Was unemployment what you ended up addressing, or were there other things in that mix? You know, if you could go back and write that report that was for you and not for anyone else, what would be in it?
Yeah. Well, that was a dominant of the time. And in personal terms, it was a dominant as well. I mean, it was what you felt was the most worthwhile about what we did. But there are heritage issues about what we did that could well be amplified by proper reporting. There were a lot of social issues that we engaged with outside of Scotland. I mean, the idea of a dementia care home, housing. We looked at trying to provide housing. But the problem with just looking at unemployment is that it does focus your mind there, and perhaps there's only so much energy that a group has and the ability to kind of unpick that a bit. So I would have liked more reflective time. That's what I would have liked. Somebody did, my 50th birthday was towards the end of this period, 1993. And somebody did a postcard, a card of me. It was five decades. And the last one was the decade of the workspace. And I think I had a phone in one hand, a broom up my arse, a notebook there, a saw in the other hand. I'll find that card and send it to you. We were victim of our own rhetoric to a certain extent, you know. We claimed a lot and were able to do a lot, but perhaps a bit more reflective time would have been useful. Yeah, in personal terms, it certainly would have. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what? So you felt like you were constantly multitasking.
Firefighting. Money, employment, stock, property, keys. Travel, because we had to work out with the community when we had the building and joinery company. A multitude of things that face every employer and every employee of a voluntary organisation. I started part-time job sharing, and I moved on to be full-time within a couple of years of that. It occupied 10 years of my life, 60, 70, 80 hours a week for most of it. I think that's, you get burned out. Well, I did. You get burned out. Mm. You're just trying to work on so many fronts. Because although I was in the Employment Opportunities Worker, what was it called? I can't remember now, something like that. Employment Opportunities Worker initially. And then I became manager of the building and joinery company because of my background. I was also involved with the other bits of the company. I was involved with promoting the company. I was involved with researching projects for development. I was involved in showing people around the premises. It was my own fault. I took it on, and willingly, but I think I got burned out, really. I was a member of Community Business Scotland, which had its office in the building, by the way, in the workspace. And so I allowed myself to be pulled in quite a number of different directions and didn't perhaps focus quite enough on the need for solidity at local level in the local project.
And do you think others within the community business movement, do you think that's a common experience of people in your role?
Well, I mean, I think if you to go back to Govan, for example, I've always admired Pat and Rosie as being very single-minded about their endeavour, you know. And although we've managed to get Pat to speak at the Scottish Parliament, for example, they do focus on property management and Govan, and their main task of developing and supporting their community-based enterprise in an area of high need. So they have... They have an exemplary approach in that sense. As for others, I can't say. I mean, many of the people I know work too hard within it. There isn't enough time for reflection, mm-hmm. leisure.
Mm. And do you think it was something about the nature of community business, trying to reconcile the community output with the enterprise output? Was that part of the...
Is there a paradox in the title of community and business? I don't know. There might be. But a paradox is worth fighting for. So did you say, is it in the nature of community enterprise?
Yeah, it's trying to reconcile those two directions of work. You know, to me that seems like a very challenging thing to do.
I think it is challenging. But I think what I want to say is that it's exciting. And what makes it exciting is the sense that it's a movement, that this is a movement for change. And so you take it on. You take it on. But maybe it makes it, well, I know it makes it more difficult. It makes it more to have very wide-ranging ambitions, both social, environmental, enterprising. It's a difficult challenge, mm. but it still seems to me to be ultimately hugely worthwhile.
Mm. And so, after 1993, what did you go on to do after?
I shifted away from Frontline. That's not quite right, really. I went and worked for an organisation called Rural Forum for a couple of years, which was a national charity based in Perth. I had an office. I worked from an office in Sanca, and I covered the southwest of Scotland in terms of... We were trying to see whether something which was called community appraisals, which grew out of parish appraisals, which was an approach developed through the rural community councils in England, developed as a methodology by Gloucester College, somebody in Gloucester College, Malcolm someone, it was essentially a way of communities coming together to look at what their local needs were. It was a bit overemphasized on being largely questionnaire based. I remember thousands and thousands of keystrokes on early Amstrad computers. I won't go into it. It was very, very mechanical. So I worked with ex-mining communities in what was then called South Lanarkshire, and Ayrshire, which is now part of, no, it was then called Clydesdale, it's now South Lancashire, in the Douglas Valley. And I worked in Newton Stewart and down in the Machers in Dumfries and Galloway, with a range of communities, working with them through community projects, helping them put together their own plans or their own wish lists for the future. I use that, and I ought to qualify that, because they were wish lists based on a questionnaire that was devised and agreed at local level, but nonetheless, which was very much questionnaire based and not stretching out enough. After a couple of years, I worked for a new charitable trust called the Corum Trust, which was a very, in many ways, a very good period of employment. I worked a lot in the Isle of Mull and the Isle of Iona, and various other places up the West Coast, helping communities put forward their future plans. And then with my colleague Colin, who had been at Corum as well, we set up the Small Town and Rural Development Group and worked on our Community Futures project, which we developed. And that was a very fruitful 15 years of work, from about 98, 99 onwards. And I stopped work. I thought when I got to 70, I ought to stop work. So I stopped work when I was 70.
And so the Community Futures work, was that around kind of 2000 that you...
We developed Community Futures first of all in Stirling, where there was pilot... Stirling was one of the pathfinder councils for community planning under Keith Yates, who was the chief exec. And we put forward the proposal to him and to various members of himself, Helen Munro in particular, who was the head of community development, that if you're going to have community planning, what you needed was communities putting into that. Otherwise, community planning was just a name. So we ran a pilot program with four communities in Stirlingshire, all around. Well, one was Doon, one was Balfron, one was... Where was it? Heavens, anyway. Four communities ran them in. And that won a Town Planning Institute award for good planning. Again, that sense of somebody sees what you're doing and appreciates that it's very useful. So from that Community Futures work in those four communities... Gargannock was another. Let me see. Doon and Easton, Gargannock, Balfron, Brigaturk. They were the four communities, were four pilots. It was a challenge project that we put out to community councils, and four responded. No, many responded, and four were picked by the local authority. And we worked in those areas. We got some money from the council, we got some money from Europe, we got... So we worked in those four communities, helping them put forward their own community futures proposals. And out of that grew the work in the National Park, Loch Lomond and Trossachs National Park. Did Colin give you a copy of the book? Oh, I brought you one. That's the book we were funded to write after the work. We worked in 23 communities around the National Park. And in each of those communities... As the National Park was coming into being, were able to put forward their own future vision for their own community and their own list of priorities, all worked through an iterative process that looked at where they were now, where they wanted to be, what they needed to do, what their ambitions were, and what the history was, and to publish together as a series of local community futures plans or community action plans. It had three elements. It really had this planning element, which is what this book is about. So that's the community coming together to put forward its own plan. It had an organisational development level where You know, if you're going to do something, you probably need to set up an organisation or to at least be organised in a way. That might mean setting up a charitable trust. It might mean setting up a local forum for different community organisations to come and work together to work on joint endeavours. And the third is around projects and project development. So there's three elements of planning, organisational development and project development. And Colin is still doing this work, and I stopped a couple of years ago. That was a terrific period of work, and built very much on the experience of the West Quarter Workspace work or involvement, and my friendship with John, who was always able to set it into the context of the broader picture, what this is for. Yeah. So that's what I did. And enjoyed it immensely. I enjoyed all of it, really. But it was time to stop. Otherwise, I thought I'd just die when I got there one day.
You mentioned how the community futures work built on your experience at West Calder. When you were meeting communities in this later period, were communities more amenable to, you know, the kind of work that you and Colin were trying to do, or were they more hostile? Was it more difficult to bring people together, or was it easier? What kind of...
Yeah. There have been some changes in the last 30 years. Mm. I mean, there is a recognition, I think, by local authorities that they have to. I mean, there's also a duty and a responsibility within all departments, local authorities, that they need to consult. Now, as we know, consultation can be a very wide spectrum. At one end of it can be of the, yes, we're consulting you, we're telling you this is what's going to happen. The other end of it, there can be the process of engaging communities and building up their strength and their ability to understand what the, you know, the wider context is, and having them engaged in that process. So, yeah, I think it's in the air much more now, this idea of consultation and as a community development, an element of community development. Having said that, there's quite a lot of hostility as well. You run into hostility. I would say vested interests is the biggest hostility that one runs into. And that could be a small group that thinks it's doing it anyway. It could be a clique. It could be the community council. A mixed bunch, in my view, community council. Somebody missed a trick in 1975 when community councils came in. They didn't give them any money, so they can't do anything. Yeah. Some communities, however, have been much more proactive in being able to engage in the future than others. There are communities where you have the same chairperson 30 years on. Perhaps not the best method of local democracy. So the most exciting thing that came out of Community Futures was the idea of two things really, the role of women, how women have been very much at the forefront in the community development that's happening across Scotland now, and new community leaders coming forward, not necessarily as women, but new community leaders coming forward. That sense that business can be done a different way. I use business in that perhaps old-fashioned sense of the word as busyness. Curiously, my last piece of work as Community Futures, within Community Futures, was in West Calder and Harbin. I'll give you a copy of that, of the community action plan that came out of that. So it sort of rounded it off in a curious way. Mm. And they latterly, the last two or three years, we worked in association with the Colfords Regeneration Trust, who had government money to do some of this work. We were commissioned by them to run out Community Futures under the banner of Colfords Regeneration Trust. That's come to an end since then. Mm. And West Calder having been a mining community, was eligible for Coalfields Regeneration Trust money funding. So that paid for the development work and provided a bit of seed corn funding for some of the projects that were prioritised in the work. So it's an interesting package that we were able to bring. It's kind of rounded it off, West Calder to West Calder. Yeah. 83 to 2013.
I was interested actually in picking up on something you mentioned there about the role of women. So far, most of the people I've talked to for my project have been men, but I'm aware that that's maybe just because of the people I've been talking to rather than that being representative of the community business movement as a whole. Was there a distinction in the kinds of things men and women were doing in the movement, or, you know, do I just need to find the women who were doing work just like you?
Well, there are, I mean, quite a lot of women engaged in community development. But I think that you need to be come at it from a slightly different angle to meet those women, although there are some very high powered and dedicated people working in the field. I think the most interesting take on it that you could get would be to meet some of the women who are running the local community projects, some of the women who've put themselves out time and time again to make things happen for their area, for their family, for their community hall. Those are the people at grassroots level who really are the foundation for a lot of really fantastic work. Fantastic work. Colin and I worked in a place called Balmoloch on the edge of Glasgow, and we worked there twice. I can't remember the dates now. Early 2003, 2004, and then maybe 2012, 2010. And their the big thing for them was they had a tenants and residence hall, which is formed to basis, absolutely disgraceful building, really. But it was the place where everything happened, in Balmoloch. And I can tell you now, where are we, 2016, that the lottery project has been funded, various huge amount of funding come together, and they are building that community hall, that new community hall, on the site of the old one. 12 years after our first engagement with them, and Lord knows when they first started thinking about trying to get a hall, because that was already a project that they had going. I'm out of touch with them, of course. You know, these things slip by. But there was a woman there called Evelyn who was absolutely brilliant and just held it together throughout that time. And, you know, the reality of that contact that they have is completely stunning, completely enlightening. And I think that's a kind of world picture as well. Okay, we don't wear suits, but we're blokes. And, you know, that has a different flavour to it, you know. And I think that there are a lot of people within the community development movement now at both activist and community level, but also at the community development level, that would be well worth talking to. As I said, right at the very beginning, Sheila Gardner, who was the community, what they call, ComEd worker, community education worker in West Calder, was an enormous support to what we were doing. And I don't think I recognised that at the time, because she was just the worker, but actually she didn't have to, she chose to, and she helped to make it happen in the first place. Yeah. I think for your next study, you should also speak to Kay Caldwell, of course.
Yeah. So I'm aware that I'm...
Oh, you've got to be somewhere.
No. I'm aware that I'm using up lots of your time. Oh. It's fascinating for me. But one thing I'd maybe just like to finish up with is... you know, some of the differences between what we now call social enterprise and what was, you know, at the time of West Calder Workspace called community business. Where do you think things started to diverge?
I thought you were going to say go wrong. Do you want some water?
No, thank you.
John was made redundant in 1990, I think, from Strathclyde Community Business. Sorry, just in Birmingham. And that was hugely symbolic for him, but it was also, I think, symbolic for the movement as a whole. Excuse me, I need to put a log on. I was wondering why it was getting cold. And there are a number of complex reasons why John was made redundant, or wasn't really made redundant, and he was asked to leave, effectively. But some of it was this whole emphasis on business and business-like approaches. I think we all recognise that, you know, enterprises need to wash themselves, but wash their faces, or whatever the phrase is. But that's such a narrow part of the picture, seems to me. So if I'm talking about the 1990s, we're really talking about the time of the poll tax, the Thatcher's gone, but John Major's in power, remarkably. there's a different emphasis, emphasis right through the country. It seems to me that there was a different sense of the way that things ought to be put together, and that money was the ruling factor. And people wanted to see, Colin would have told you about Barrowfield when it was closed down and stuff like that, you know. People wanted to see returns. They weren't able to take a long-term view. We all know that, you know, local authority cycle is 4 years or whatever it is, government's 5 years. And so that cuts out the ability for people to take a longer term. Look at the way that short-termism became espoused and is still ruling the world. Now, I mean, the whole debate about Europe seems to me to be absolutely fascinating. I'm a huge supporter of us being in Europe. That's my view. War baby. I know what it was like, as it were. But nobody is saying it's actually the corporations that are running the world now. It's the power. There's been a huge shift of power. But that's not part of the debate, you know. So you've got little Englanders and so on, rabbiting away about sovereignty. It's disappearing. You know, the world is run by the industrial military complex more and more and more. And some of it has a wee benign face here and there, but not very much. So I think there was a shift away from the idea that collectivism, I'll use the word quite specifically, people working together for the greater good, common good, wasn't what we should be looking at, wasn't the way in which things should be judged and looked at. That the bottom line was the important thing. Loads of money, you remember, loads of money. So I think there was a moment that perhaps started in the early 60s and moved through the 70s and into the 80s, and then by the 90s, that had gone down. And what has emerged now under the social enterprise banner is a different thing. Hugely wide ranging, and no problem in that. I have absolutely no problem in that. But that sense that community is doing things for themselves, getting organised to change the life of the people who are the most disadvantaged, that's not where the world is at the moment. I can't really add to that without...
What I think is interesting is within that, we have in Scotland this new kind of community ownership powers that are coming into play. How do you think that fits with these bigger general trends, perhaps towards individualism and whatever that,
well,
you know, you were talking
like
about?
Like everything else, it's a mixed blessing. I mean, what underwrites that is the fact that the whole idea of municipalness, of the power of local authorities, to be used for the good, is being undermined. The squeeze on local authorities is so much now that frontline services are disappearing. Their room for manoeuvre, their wriggle room for supporting projects like I was involved in, is almost zero now. And so community empowerment, well, I'm fully supportive of it, and the community ownership of assets is seen as an alternative to the state through its various arms taking on development. Now, there are good things and bad things about that, but there's also a kind of unspoken agenda that it ain't going to be done for you anymore. You're out there on your own. You're going to have to, you're going to have ownership of this building, this project, this woodland, and that brings the ability for you to develop it and to look after it and to exploit it, but it also brings the responsibility of looking after it. And are you really in a position to do that? Are communities really in a position to do that? What happened to the whole idea of subsidiarity? You know, where if communities are not in a position to do that, then the community comes together through its local authority, as an example, to do things. And that seems to be a bit of a missing link now, there you are, do it. Okay, scary. It is really scary. It's not the answer to everything. It seems to me to be a result of a political approach rather than for its own sake, for its best sake.
And do you feel optimistic about the future of social enterprise and its role in society?
I'm not directly involved in social enterprise anymore as I was. I would like it to sharpen its philosophy. I would like it to look at the world. I would like it to look at the way I look at the world, but it's not going to do that. And why should it? But I would like it to take on some of those values that we were looking at, that we were engaged with 20, 30 years ago. And in particular, I think it's because
almost, although there is a core set of core values that social enterprises take on, and you know, for the greater, you know, the common good and the greater benefit in some ways or other, they seem to me to be so wide now that almost anything can be a social enterprise. Almost anything can be led by that strange being, a social entrepreneur. You translate social entrepreneur, it means undertaker, but that's another matter.
I don't have any more questions, Alan, but is there anything further you'd like to mention, anything you feel like missed out, or that we said, oh, we'll go back to that, and we didn't, or...
I have nothing I can think of at the moment. I can't think of anything. No.
Brilliant. Okay. Nothing more. If it's all right with you, I'll stop there.